Well, we have just gone and done it. We just intercepted a letter intended for someone else. We just sat here and listened to a message from God to the earliest Christians in the reading that we heard from Revelation. And we should now be on our guard. When unintended recipients receive a communication intended for someone else, unexpected things can happen. It can be absolutely shocking. There was once a couple from Minnesota who were planning their 25th wedding anniversary. They decided to celebrate that anniversary down in Florida in the very same hotel where they had spent their honeymoon a quarter of a century earlier. They had hectic schedules, this couple, so the husband went down a day early in advance of his wife. He checked into a hotel, and he was surprised to find, when he got there, a personal computer that was available for his use. So he decided to send a loving email to his devoted wife. And he did so. But as he did so, he accidentally hit 2 wrong keys. The email would be going to an unintended recipient. In the meantime, somewhere in the Houston metropolitan area, a widow had just returned home from her husband's funeral. He'd been a faithful man, a member of the clergy, who'd been called to glory after a sudden and unexpected heart attack. When the new widow entered her bedroom, she sought some comfort, so she decided to check her email, hoping to get a message or two from a family member or a friend. When she read the very first message that she saw on that screen, she screamed and fainted to the floor. Her son came rushing into the bedroom, found his mother collapsed on the floor, and then when he looked over at the computer on which she had been reading, he found this message. "My dear wife, I know you're surprised to hear from me. They have personal computers here now. And you're allowed to send emails to your loved ones. I've just arrived and been checked in. I've seen that everything is prepared for your arrival tomorrow. Looking forward to seeing you then. Hope your journey is as uneventful as mine was. Your loving husband. P.S. It's freaking hot down here." Well, let me ask you, what is going to happen to us now? Now that we find ourselves included in a communication originally intended for the people of the early church, lo, those centuries ago. You see, Revelation was a pastoral letter written to a group of Christians in crisis. It was a desperate letter of hope to a group of people who were in a desperate situation. The Roman Emperor Diocletian was fomenting the first general persecution of Christian people, and those people were facing unthinkable atrocities and abject fear. The letter's author, John, was a church leader, and he'd been exiled to the island of Patmos in the Aegean Sea, and he was writing back to his followers in Anatolia, modern-day Turkey. The letter was written to shore them up, to give them strength and hope in the face of a situation that appeared absolutely hopeless. And you know what? Those early Christians were neither the first nor the last children of God, to face trying times. As we all know, all too well, life can be a struggle. Life can wear us out. We can lose hope. Consider Jacob and the journey that he was on. It wasn't a pleasant journey. It was not a hopeful journey. He was running away from home, running away from the murderous wrath of his brother Esau after having stolen Esau's birthright and the blessing of his father. Jacob was a wanted man, and Jacob was a haunted man. He was filled with fear. One thing of which Jacob was empty was hope. In this state and in this place, we're told that Jacob took a stone, put it under his head, and lay down in that place. In the imagination of my heart, I'm convinced that as Jacob did so, he groaned. In his loneliness, his longing hopelessness, in the face of a future that seemed to have failed him, he groaned as he lay himself down to sleep. Jacob was miles from nowhere. He was a world away from hope. And we know this moment. We know what it is to hope for what we cannot see, to long for what seems to be beyond our grasp. At the center of our soul, there is a yearning that is so powerful, a longing that is so desperate, that we sometimes shrink back and we're virtually paralyzed in our efforts to move ahead. We cannot have the life we want. We cannot have the relationships that we so fervently desire. We cannot see the hope that can propel us through the pain that sometimes permeates our lives. Sometimes, in our emotional exhaustion, drained of all purpose, emptied and blind to any hope, all we have left, it seems, in those moments is a groaning emptiness deep inside our souls. Like Jacob, we wait and we wonder and we groan in our longing, paralyzed hoping for a way out. In the early evening of December the 4th, 1953, a young seamstress, exhausted from hours on her feet, got on the Cleveland Avenue bus in Montgomery, Alabama. Her name was Rosa Parks, and she was tired to her very bones. She plopped down in the very first empty seat that she came to, in the front of the bus. When the bus driver ordered her to get up and move to the back, she simply sat there in silence. She sat there because she was just too physically tired to move. But she was also morally and emotionally exhausted. She was tired of the indignities, tired of the inhuman injustices that had been codified into law as Jim Crow segregation. After the police arrested her and hauled her off to jail in the Montgomery City Jail, one of the officers asked the bus driver what Rosa Parks had said when he had demanded that she move to the back of the bus. "It's funny," the man said. "She didn't say a thing. She just sat there, closed her eyes, and groaned." But you see, what the bus driver could not know was this. Buried within her exhaustion, hidden under the hopelessness, there was hope. And in the empty groan of that tired and lonely seamstress, the civil rights movement that transformed an entire nation was born. A dream of hope was born. And there is always hope. As we sit here today, some of us at the front of the bus, but much more of us like good Episcopalians toward the back, we all know all too well that we have our own personal reasons to groan. We are all, each and every one of us, waiting. We are waiting for some change in circumstances. We are waiting for some improvement in the world around us. We are waiting for some dream of hope. And as we wait, may we be given the grace to cling to the dream that was granted to our brother Jacob, the dream that gave him hope, the hope that led him to life. As he lay there in groaning, stony isolation, he was granted a vision, a dream. We know that vision, that dream, as Jacob's ladder. And on that ladder, angels were ascending and descending between heaven and earth. Earth and heaven are connected. We are never cut off. We are never, ever cut off from the sustaining love of God. The earth and our lives upon it is a habitat of hope. And you know what? Jesus himself longs for you and me to share in that vision, that dream. That is exactly why he told Nathanael, "You will see heaven opened and the angels of God ascending and descending upon the Son of Man." Jesus is our Jacob's ladder. There is always hope. That same ultimate and everlasting hope is hidden under the surface of the letter from which we heard this morning, the reading from Revelation that we intercepted today. A heavenly battle is described as Michael and his angels join in the battle. The outcome is foretold. The forces of chaos and evil are defeated. And the writer of the letter assures his persecuted followers that there was no longer any place for those dark forces in God's plan in heaven. And here, even for those persecuted ones, there was hope. Here was assurance in the face of seeming hopelessness that God was in control and the world would be made right. Those Christians facing the outbreak of persecution were in a battle against the empire, but the ultimate outcome was already assured. There was no room for those dark forces in God's plan. Things may look bleak, beyond bad, but God is always at work. There is always hope. The wonderful poet Emily Dickinson gave poetic expression to this wonderful reality of our existence on this habitat of hope when she wrote, "Hope is the thing with feathers that perches in the soul and sings the tune without the words and never stops at all." Hope is always singing to us, even when we cannot hear. Hope is a gift that God always offers. The possibility of hope is never snuffed out. There is always hope. One of the great blessings of my personal life arrived unexpectedly and undeservedly back when I was in seminary in New York City. I was blessed to have as my professor one year Archbishop Desmond Tutu of South Africa. And blessing upon blessing, I had the undeserved privilege to serve as Desmond's personal and student assistant. He was on sabbatical from his ministry back in South Africa, and he'd retreated, literally retreated, to my seminary in the dark days of apartheid. P.W. Botha was residing in the presidential palace in Pretoria. Nelson Mandela languished in the 20th year of a life sentence on Robben Island. And Archbishop Tutu's own people had turned against them at that time because he was insisting that they not resort to violence in their struggle for freedom. He was isolated and threatened on every side, and he was literally spent. Desmond received the Nobel Prize for Peace during his time with us in New York. And on the day on which the prize was announced, hordes of reporters and other media types descended upon the seminary. It became my job to bring order to the throngs of interviewers and to shepherd them in to meet with the Archbishop one-on-one. I remember hours of interviews by the likes of Tom Brokaw, Dan Rather, many others. But you know, of all the questions and answers that I listened to that day, here is the exchange that I most remember. The question was posed by Peter Jennings. The answer was provided by Desmond Tutu. "Archbishop Tutu," Jennings asked, "are you ever tempted to give up hope? And are you ever afraid?" I remember that Archbishop Tutu's verbal response was slow in coming, but his eyes shined brilliantly as he searched the face of the famous anchor for some hint of recognition. And finally, Archbishop Tutu responded in a strong voice of steady strength that belied his exhausted state. "Mr. Jennings," he said with just a hint of annoyance in his voice, "as I think you know, I am a Christian. And as such, I cling against all odds to a sure and certain hope of a resurrection to eternal life. The worst thing that anyone can ever do to me is kill me. But they will never destroy my hope, and they cannot ultimately take my life. So no, I never lose hope, and I am never afraid. Mr. Jennings, I am hopelessly hopeful. I hope you understand what I'm talking about." I would suggest to us this morning that being hopelessly hopeful is one definition of what it means to call oneself a Christian. It might sometimes seem, on the surface of things, to be the height of unbridled optimism. But for us Christians, it simply means staying in touch with what is always there. There is always hope, forever and ever. Amen.